Start by saying, I don't even know where to start with this case. I find this case to be very difficult. It's a result that makes sense to me, but I don't know how you get there. So here's what I want to do. First thing is, let's try to figure out what's going on. This is a lawsuit about two lawsuits, which I think is ultimately what makes it difficult, what makes the result seem sensible, but no one knows exactly how to get there. So the actual lawsuit before the Supreme Court is Baker versus GM. And what's that case about? Yeah, it's a products case. You're right, it's wrongful death. The parent, the mother I think it is, of the plaintiffs, was killed in an accident, and of the plaintiffs alleged because the GM product she was riding in was defective. The case is really, though, ultimately not about this case. It's about a dispute between GM and one of its former employees. And everybody pick up what's going on? What was the dispute between GM and Elwell, or Ewell, or however you pronounce his name? What was that really about? We get the context for what was going on. Yeah.
He sued them for retaliation after they fired him after he testified, and then they sued him for sharing.
Yeah, the plaintiff, the employee, is a whistleblower, right? He testified against GM in a previous products liability suit, and in so doing, at least according to GM, misappropriated a lot of confidential information, proprietary information to GM, and disclosed it to the plaintiffs in that case. So they fired him. He sued for wrongful discharge, and GM counterclaimed for breach of fiduciary duty. GM and the employee ended up resolving that dispute out of court through a settlement agreement. And what did the settlement agreement do? What were the terms of the settlement agreement? Among other things, in the settlement agreement, the employee agreed to not testify against GM in any future litigation or litigation ongoing, except for one suit. They carved out one suit that was ongoing. Now think about this. I mean, the injunction, they got the court to issue an injunction. I should ask this again. So how many of you have worked as a law clerk or are currently working as a law clerk who have had some experience with litigation? Anybody? Some. I mean, just a modicum. I'm not saying like you could litigate a case today, but you've seen. So anybody see how settlements happen, been a part of a settlement, drafted a settlement agreement? Generally speaking, if you have civil litigation and the parties reach a settlement agreement, that's it. Other than a class action, parties pretty much are free to settle cases as they choose, on whatever terms they choose, and when they do, they do. Now, a settlement agreement is a contract. It's a form of a contract. So if one side then subsequently breaches the settlement agreement, the other side can go back into court and seek to enforce that settlement agreement. And most states allow the parties to do that, the non-breaching party to do that, by going in and reopening the first action. Although not all states, some states you have to file a second lawsuit to enforce the settlement agreement. But other than that, the settlement agreement is generally not part of the court docket. In this case, though, because of what the parties are trying to do, right, they've agreed that the employee is not going to testify on behalf of GM any longer. They go into court and actually get the court to do that by a consent order, an injunction that prohibits the employee from testifying. Now, you can imagine if you were, first of all, you can imagine why GM wanted this as part of the settlement agreement. You can also imagine if you were representing the plaintiff, ultimately why you might be willing to agree to this. Because ultimately, what's he out, really? What he really wants is the money that he lost when he lost his job. Obviously, he felt strongly enough to testify about this, so he probably has some sense of moral indignation that GM's going to go on perpetrating these horrible wrongs in product liability, but he's probably happy to deal with that, have that guilty conscience in exchange for some money, right? But you can also imagine, because after all, he gets to testify in the Georgia action. He spoke his piece in one case, and good for him. But you can also imagine, had you been representing the employee, you might be a little bit concerned about this provision in the settlement agreement. Which, why might you be concerned about agreeing that your client will not testify in future litigation? Yeah.
Because if you had like a subpoena to testify, then you would have to choose between violating a court order to testify or violating your contract.
I point this out only to carve out, I think the court perhaps ascribes a little bit more significance to this than I think there was. I think a good lawyer talking to a client would say, hey, this is an easy thing for you to give on. After all, what do you really care if you can't testify in the future against GM? You can get some money out of GM, which is really what you need right now. On the other hand, a good lawyer would also say, but we have to be careful here because a court might order you to testify. You have relevant evidence. A court could issue a subpoena, and if the court issues a subpoena, I don't want you caught in the position where you will be in violation of that order, the subpoena. And so let's make clear that we'll agree to this, but we want GM to agree that if you are compelled to testify under a subpoena, GM's not going to seek to hold you in contempt of this consent decree. And that's probably the best the parties can do, right? Because they don't know. They know that's a potential thing out there. They could agree, and probably did agree, that if the plaintiff, or the employee rather, were subpoenaed, the employee would provide notice to GM. I'm sure if we pulled up the settlement agreement, we would see, and allow GM to come in and seek to quash the subpoena. In fact, that's what happened in the Baker case. That's what GM tried to do. Could say that the employee has to raise defenses to the subpoena on behalf of GM. I bet there's something to that effect too. But ultimately, if you're the lawyer for the employee, you've got to realize that there's a very, at least there's a possibility, remote or real, who knows, that your client may end up in this position where the court's, one court's compelling him to testify, he's agreed to a consent decree in another court that says he can't testify. And so the parties say, okay, how do we resolve this so that we can, the lawyers realistically say, well, how do we get past this? Because we think we got a deal on the table that everyone can live with except for this one little problem. How do we get past this? And we say, okay, GM gets a chance to raise its defenses. It's all it really wants. And then it'll agree, assuming that the subpoena is not quashed, it won't seek to hold this guy in contempt in Michigan. Okay, great. And note, so, and I say this because note, the consent decree that the court issues, this is the consent decree. This is what the court order says. The settlement agreement then has the language that says GM agrees, as another term of the agreement, that it won't seek to hold the guy in breach of the agreement or in contempt of the consent decree if he's compelled to testify under court order. It seems like it was probably just some good, pragmatic, common sense compromise to get a settlement agreement done in the case that otherwise would have gone unresolved because the parties didn't really know what to do in the event that this thing happened. Okay, so then you get to the Baker's case. They file a lawsuit. They read the Georgia decision or talk to some plaintiff's lawyers who've represented plaintiffs against GM, somehow along the line, discover that this guy testified in the Georgia litigation and go, aha, this would be a very useful person to have as an expert on our side, and seek to get his testimony. And what do? They subpoena him. And now the question is, so to what extent does this consent decree actually have any effect in the Missouri litigation? Okay. So I say that this seems like there's a couple of common sense principles that Justice Ginsburg talks about. One, she talks about the fact that full faith and credit applies in equity. Believe it or not, this is actually the first time the Supreme Court expressly said that. So if for no other reason, the decision's significant because Ginsburg says that in the majority opinion. She also says there's no public policy exception to the full faith and credit clause. Hopefully that didn't come as big news to you, right? Because that's the whole point of the Fauntleroy case, the very first case we started with in this case, where Mississippi wants to say, we've got to enforce this judgment that's counter to one of our fundamental public policies, and the court says, oh well. Now, if all I told you was full faith and credit applies in equity, applies to a judgment, an equitable decree, as much as it does to a money judgment. And there's no public policy exception to the full faith and credit clause. If all I told you was that, would you think that the Missouri court here would have to enforce or recognize the Michigan consent decree? Or would you think that Missouri could actually compel the employee to testify? What seems to be the inevitable conclusion of those two things? To me, it seems like the inevitable conclusion, if Missouri has to give effect to this consent decree, Missouri can't let him testify. But note that he's not the result. Every justice agrees that that's not the right result. They all just have different reasons why, how they get there. So how do you get from these two things that seem pretty unobjectionable and seem to suggest that the Missouri court should not be able to compel this guy, how do you get from there to the idea that ultimately the Missouri court is okay, they can ignore the Michigan injunction? Well, the other thing that Justice Ginsburg talks a lot about is the idea that the enforcing state has to give full faith and credit, enforce the judgment, give it the same credit, the same effect that the rendering state would, but does not have to use the manner or mechanism for enforcement. The manner or mechanism does not travel with the judgment, is the language of the court. So I want to talk a little bit about what that means and why that might be ultimately what makes this case a little bit of a tricky case to decide. I've got a couple of hypotheticals here. Here's what I'd like you to do. Take a couple minutes, work in groups, and see if you can't get through the first series of hypotheticals on the first page here, A, B, C, D. Thank you. All right, so let's assume, hypothetically, that they'd actually tried this case. The plaintiff wins the wrongful discharge case, and the jury awards him $100,000 in damages, and now he's seeking to enforce that judgment against assets and GM. He started by telling you, assume, under Missouri law, judgments are not self-executing. By the way, that's what we talked about in Ohio. Judgments are not self-executing in Ohio. You have to go to the clerk of court and get a writ of execution. So Missouri has a similar process, but also, just presume for fun today, that Michigan doesn't. The judgment is, in fact, self-executing. I'm 100% sure that that is inaccurate. For those of you who are intending to practice in Michigan, know now, put it aside, judgments are not self-executing in Michigan. But for the sake of argument, let's pretend that they are. So the employee shows up with the Michigan judgment, goes to the sheriff of Missouri and says, aha, I execute against property here in Missouri because I've got this Michigan judgment. Does the Missouri sheriff have to execute on the judgment, or can he say, no, 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 you have to have a writ of execution issued by a court? What do you think? Who wants to give it a try? Yeah.
This seems easier than the others.
I believe it to be, yes.
Yes, that since it is just an enforcement mechanism, that all it is getting is the writ of execution, so that yes, I guess the sheriff can refuse.
The sheriff can insist on a writ of execution. Anybody think differently, or everybody come up with that same idea? Yeah, I mean, that's the answer, and that makes sense. By the way, why does that make sense?
Well, one, because just even dividing it into recognition and enforcement is it's just a very simple way of
You know, this is actually part, we're not saying, are we saying here that the Missouri court, or the Missouri sheriff, ultimately is not going to enforce the judgment? No, he's going to enforce the judgment. You just have to take this procedural step of getting the writ of execution before the sheriff will enforce the judgment. So I want to be, we're parsing this out even clearer. When we started this whole, even more finely, we started this whole thing, we talked about recognition versus enforcement. And recognition is just acknowledging in some way, giving some kind of effect, acknowledging that the first court has issued a judgment. Enforcement means making the parties take some action on whatever that court order was. We're still talking about making the parties take some action, right? We're not suggesting that GM isn't going to pay here. We're saying that the way in which you make GM take action is pursuant to Missouri law, and that is, or I'm sorry, the way you make the employee get GM to take action, and that is you've got to go to the court and get the writ of execution. That's the idea that the mechanisms for enforcing don't travel, just the judgment. And the necessity to enforce the judgment itself. And so this is a pretty easy case. Okay, next one. We talked about this with respect to Ohio, too. Right? Missouri law, like Ohio, has a list. Certain assets are protected assets. You can't enforce a judgment against them. Like your home is always a good one. There's always some kind of caveat for some portion of your home that, you know, or some real property that the asset, the judgment can't be executed against. Let's say Michigan, though, has a different list of protected assets. So now you've got a Michigan judgment. The employee wants to enforce that Michigan judgment in Missouri against assets which are located in Missouri that would be protected under Missouri law. Can Missouri refuse to enforce the judgment against those assets? What do you think? Anybody come to a different conclusion? Brittany, you're right. This is still about the mechanism, the manner in which the judgment is enforced. For exactly the reason you say, there's other assets out there. You can enforce it against those other assets, but you can't enforce it against those that Missouri has carved out. One more thing, most states have some provision that says you've got to seek that writ of execution and seek to enforce the judgment within a certain period of time. So let's say Missouri has a particularly short, 2 years would be a very short window. So let's say Missouri has 2 years. Michigan, on the other hand, would allow for 10 years, which is a more common, 10 years after judgment would be a more common period. And so the employee goes down to Missouri to enforce the judgment within 10 years, but past the 2-year Missouri limit. Does Missouri have to enforce the judgment?
We said no.
Why not? So that actually, I'm not sure that supports the no, though, right? Generally, but let's flesh this out for a minute. When we were talking just about just the underlying cause of action, choice of law, remember that whole idea of remedy versus substantive? One of the distinctions that courts drew under the first restatement, and even to some extent under the second restatement and under interest analysis, was this idea of the difference between substance and procedure, or right and remedy, and always use that distinction as a justification for applying forum law. When we're talking about the remedy, when we're talking about procedure, there's good cause for the forum to apply its own law. It's only when it comes to substance. Is that different when we're talking about the judgment? Which suggests what? Can Missouri apply its 2-year period, or does it have to apply Michigan's 10-year period? And that's the answer, right? Yet again, this is another enforcement mechanism. Missouri can put all kinds of its own limitations on the way in which the $100,000 gets collected, as long as ultimately it's recognizing and enforcing the judgment for $100,000. And this is just another one of the ways in which Missouri can put limitations on it. Now, you've got to be careful. There's a Supreme Court decision. So almost all states have a statute of limitations. You've got to seek to enforce the judgment within a statute at a certain period of time, 10 years. And they usually run from the date of judgment. So let's say the date of judgment is 2002. It's now 2012, I think. Please tell me I'm right about that. You're representing a client who got a judgment in 2002. You look and see it's 2012. That means the statute of limitations is running. If you haven't executed that judgment yet, you need to, right? Now, it may be the case that the defendant doesn't have enough assets. Who knows what the problem might be? But for some reason, you're still negotiating with the defendant about some other matter, so you're trying to not collect or enforce on this thing as a way to resolve some other matter. There may be some reason why you're not ready to enforce the judgment. Most states have a procedure that allow you to revive the judgment. Much like many states have a savings procedure under the statute of limitations for substantive cause of action. So you can revive the judgment within that 10-year period or within whatever the window of the state is. Sometimes it's after it expires, you get 2 more years to revive it. So you have to 2014. But most states have some provision that allow you to revive a judgment. Now, there's a Supreme Court case where the winning party gets a judgment in the rendering state, revives the judgment in the rendering state, and then in the enforcing state, wants to enforce it having revived it. The rendering state says that's validly revived. The enforcing state says no, that's after the statute of limitations. And the Supreme Court essentially treats the revived judgment like a new judgment. The enforcing state can apply its own statute of limitations, but it has to apply it to the revived judgment as opposed to the original judgment. So a little bit of a kind of a funky thing there. But ultimately, the statute of limitations, the time in which you have to enforce the action, or the judgment rather, is considered to be part of that manner or mechanism for enforcing as opposed to the actual enforcement of the judgment itself. Okay, last one. So up till here, A, B, C, well, anybody see a distinction between the first three and D? Anybody find D to be a harder case? But let me try to clarify, too, make sure we all understand what's happening. Under Missouri law, you get a Missouri judgment from a Missouri trial court, and you walk right across the hall to the clerk of the Missouri trial court, and you say, here's my judgment, and she says, here's your writ of execution, go execute. Missouri law also provides, if what you have instead of the Missouri judgment is a piece of paper from the Michigan court, and you go to the clerk of the courts and you say, here's my judgment. The clerk of the court goes, no thanks. Instead, you have to go to the Missouri trial court file a new lawsuit. In that lawsuit, prove to the trial court judge that you have a judgment by showing the judge the piece of paper that says, look, the Michigan court gave me a judgment. That judge then turns around and says, okay, takes your Michigan piece of paper and hands you a Missouri piece of paper that says, now you have a Missouri judgment. And then you can go to the clerk of the court with the Missouri piece of paper and say, ah, now I want a writ of execution. Can Missouri really do that? That is, make you domesticate your Michigan judgment, exchange it with the judge for a Missouri judgment. So how many people think, yeah, this is okay, Missouri can do this? Anybody think no? Why are you guys troubled by this? What's the distinction between this and all the previous examples? Now, they can't do that. Let me clarify. The Missouri judge can't do anything other than check to see that you really have a Michigan judgment and exchange it for a Missouri judgment.
So you would always win?
You would always win, assuming you really have a Michigan judgment. You always win. But you still have to do that. You still have to switch the pieces of paper. I'm going to come in the next couple of hypotheticals why you might have to switch the pieces of paper, but that's what it is. Just switch the Michigan paper for the Missouri paper and then go over to the Missouri clerk of court. Yeah.
Even if it's only in a technical sense, they're refusing to enforce another state's judgment, but rather just forcing you to transform it into your own state's judgment.
But it's ultimately going to be the same thing. It's just going to be on the Missouri paper instead of the Michigan paper, but still not good enough, huh? I mean, so why do you guys think this is okay? It's not all that different than the first ones, right? At the end of the day, GM still has to pay $100,000 against ASSA, and they can be collected from assets in Missouri. The plaintiff, before the plaintiff can get the $100,000, has to go into the court and do the paper shifting. Yeah.
I guess it just seems that they're not enforcing an out-of-state judgment because they're requiring you to get, they won't do anything but enforce their in-state judgments.
And how do you draw the line between that and the writ of execution? Because requiring the plaintiff to get the writ of execution, in a sense, is requiring an order, although not a judgment. So is that the difference, that the writ is just a writ, as opposed to the Missouri judgment is a judgment?
Well, the writ of execution is based on the writ of execution is issued because you have a judgment from wherever. Mm-hmm. But in Missouri, like in this hypo, the Missouri court will only issue the writ, or the clerk will only issue the writ if you have a Missouri judgment. So you can't. So if you, I don't know. It just seems like they're saying your foreign judgment isn't good enough, so you have to just turn it into a domestic judgment.
Turns out you can actually do this. You know, and I think you can, and in fact, many states still require that, although there's now, I think the notes point out, there's a uniform recognition of and enforcement of foreign judgments, which kind of tries to curtail this domesticating step. But even Justice Scalia, and so Anybody pick up on Scalia's concurring opinion? Justice Scalia, as always, finds a nice, really simple way out of this. And what does he think is the problem with what GM's trying to do in Missouri?
Just that it's asking a court in one state to do something. Well, I guess one state is ordering another state.
I mean, Scalia says exactly that. The enforcement measures don't travel. Missouri is no more obliged to enforce the Michigan injunction than it was obliged to enforce it by holding him in contempt. No execution can issue upon judgment without a new suit in the tribunal of other states. To give force to the judgment, it must be made a judgment. To be give force to the judgment in another state, it must be made a judgment there and can only be executed in the way. So, I mean, as far as he's concerned, this is the whole problem. The only reason that the Missouri court doesn't have to honor this consent decree is the fact that GM didn't do the paper shifting. And that what full faith and credit really requires is the paper shifting. Got to domesticate the judgment once you do. And that all the full faith and credit clause obligates the enforcing state to do is to domesticate the rendering state's judgment and then enforce it. This is okay. You know, one thing I think is somewhat problematic, and I think maybe this is what you were getting at without articulating precisely, is it requires an extra step of the foreign state judgment. In those first three hypotheticals, it didn't matter whether you had a Missouri judgment or a Michigan judgment. You had to do the same thing. But this actually imposes a little bit of a different enforcement mechanism with respect to the out-of-state judgment in the sense that you've got to do that extra step and domesticate it. Even so, and even though the court always talks about you need to enforce them in an even-handed way, this is okay. Why it might be okay, consider the next one. So the jury awards the employee $100,000. GM actually pays, and the employee still goes to Missouri and seeks to enforce the judgment in Missouri. In the process of the paper shuffling, normally, turn in your Michigan judgment before you can get your Mizzou judgment. There has to be notice issued to the bank you're going to garnish against, to the underlying defendant, debtor that you're going to garnish. And then after a period, after that notice, then you get your Missouri judgment. So number two, what do you think is the result when the plaintiff wants to enforce this judgment and GM gets that notice and comes in and says, whoa, wait, we paid. Hold on. Can Missouri say, oh yeah, okay, judgment satisfied, we're not going to honor that, or does Missouri have to actually enforce the Michigan judgment? Okay, you all know what the answer has to be, right? What does the answer have to be? Missouri has to be able to refuse to enforce the judgment, right? To recognize the defense. It makes no sense to think that a state has to keep enforcing judgments that the debtor's already satisfied. So even when we talk about enforcement, there's got to be some room for the enforcing state to actually look a little bit into what's going on. Not at the underlying merits of whether GM should have had to pay $100,000, but definitely to take some note of the factual setting of the context. And if GM can show that it's already paid the $100,000, then Missouri doesn't have an obligation to enforce this judgment again. In fact, has an obligation to not enforce the judgment. Okay, so that's got to be the answer. All fine and good when we talk about money. a little bit of gray area, but seems like we can do a pretty good job parsing out what's the manner or the mechanism for enforcing versus what is actually enforcing the judgment. Now let's talk a little bit about equity. So let's say that the employee lost the first suit. Now the employee goes into Missouri and files a second suit alleging wrongful discharge. Okay, we all know the answer to that too, right? Missouri has to dismiss that suit, has to recognize the Michigan judgment in favor of GM. Now try one more, number four. What if instead employee wins the Michigan lawsuit? Or I'm sorry, I did it the other way, didn't I? GM wins the lawsuit in Michigan, and as part of the order, the court issues an injunction that prohibits the employee, because remember, part of the problem here is that the employee has confidential information, proprietary information about GM, right? So GM wins, and the court orders the employee, prohibits the employee from working for a competitor using that proprietary information for a competitor. The employee goes down to Missouri, says, I'm not having that, and tries to start working for Mitsubishi down in Missouri. What happens when GM files a lawsuit in Missouri alleging that that's in breach of the injunction in Michigan? It seems like it should, right? That's got to be the answer. I should probably also at this point ask another question in case people don't have a good context for what this looks like. Take the interstate component out of there. Let's just say that a Michigan trial court finds that this guy breached a fiduciary duty and misappropriated confidential information and issues an injunction prohibiting him from working for any competing car manufacturer. And then he just goes down the street to Ford in Michigan and says, I'm going to work for them. And so GM goes back into the very same court in Michigan and says, wait, you said this guy can't do this. Okay, we all know the answer is that the Michigan court will enforce that order, enforce its order. Does anybody know how? It's a little different than money, right? If GM's supposed to pay this guy, we all know that either GM writes a check, or if GM doesn't, the sheriff goes and starts seizing and selling stuff that GM has. But what happens if what the court says is don't pay him something, just don't do something, or affirmatively do something? Well, he's in contempt of the order, of the court's injunction. And so GM would institute contempt proceedings in the first court, and the court can hold the employee in contempt for violating the order. That's fine and good to know that that's the term, but that still doesn't answer the question, right, of, okay, he's in contempt. Woo-hoo. Woo-hoo, good for him, right? Now, how does the court actually go about getting this guy to stop working for Ford? Any ideas? Go ahead. Yeah, well, that's one possible remedy. It turns out that the court has a lot of discretion when it comes to contempt in ways to deal with an employee or a person like this employee who is violating one of its orders. One of the things it can do is put people in jail. And can do it in two different ways. I should start by saying there's really kind of two different things the court can be trying to do when it finds someone in contempt of its orders. It can just be trying to coerce that person into complying with the order, which is what we're talking about here. Sometimes, actually, the court's just punishing someone flat out for violating an order. So it could just throw this guy in jail for some definite amount of time just to punish him for the fact that he violated the order. It could, on the other hand, be genuinely interested in trying to get the guy to stop working for Ford, and so it can put him in jail indefinitely until he agrees to stop doing it. Of course, that's a pretty draconian thing to do. What might you do short of that? But don't get, is within the contempt power of the court. Can do it. Actually faced this in practice. My whole I purposely went into civil litigation because I did not want to deal with the ickiness of having to tell people that they may be going to jail or other more serious things, because I'm just really not that serious of a person. And here I am in civil litigation representing a nonprofit in a lawsuit with against another nonprofit where everybody's goody-two-shoes and the world is beautiful and it's so nice. And all of a sudden, I've got a client who the judge says, I'm going to throw your client in contempt. I'm going to find your client in contempt to put her in jail. And I'm sitting there saying, you might want to bring a toothbrush to court tomorrow. I don't know. So it is real. She didn't go to jail. Thank you. Thank you for all of us. But what might you do short of putting the person in jail?
You, like, seize his car so he can't drive to work or something?
Or just fine him, right? I mean, yes, you could potentially seize his car. I've never seen a judge actually do that. But instead, I'm going to fine you $1,000, $5,000, $10,000. You might find out how much he makes, basically, on a daily basis, and fine him that amount plus one for every day until he stops going to work. That tends to be effective, too. If you're losing money by going to work, most people will choose not to go to work. But there's a lot of way that the court, and again, the court might also fine him to compensate GM for the money it lost in having to bring the contempt proceedings. If GM can find a way to quantify the money it loses by having this guy use the proprietary information with Ford, it might fine him that. Fair amount of discretion, but that's what the court would do to enforce it. Well, same thing. We know somehow, some way, just because we cross state lines, the Missouri court's got to have some obligation to honor that Michigan decree. What that entails then, what that looks like, though, becomes a little bit tricky. I think that's really what makes this case, the GM case, so I think that's one of the things that makes the case so difficult for the court, is the fact that what you do to make the recalcitrant party comply looks so much different and is so much more intrusive. And there's so much more variation. You know, the reality is most states have about the same, there's some differences, but not a whole lot, about the same procedures for enforcing money judgments. But what states do in contempt, there's a lot more variation. I think that's one of the problems. The other is, so what this really, though, is not number four. It's really number five, right? And that changes the dynamics a little bit, too. So what do you think it is that, even though it seems pretty clear, full faith and credit has to apply in some way to this Michigan decree, and that it's not good enough for Missouri to say, we just don't like it. It offends our notion of public policy to say that somebody isn't going to testify. Somebody who has relevant evidence can't be compelled to testify just because the defendant doesn't like it, or even because the defendant made a deal with him not to. Right, that seems against our public policy, but we know that's not a reason to not honor it. So then why is it? How does the majority get to the idea that Missouri does not have to honor this judgment?
They talked about it being evidence, and they could, one court couldn't tell another court what they could improve as evidence.
And why do you think that's so? So what is it particularly? Because after all, any given court has a whole lot of reasons why they don't allow things to be evidence, right? So what is it that's particularly offensive in this case? There's two dynamics that make this difficult for the case. One, or for the court. One is that. That this, ultimately, it's the Bakers who lose out as a result of this settlement and consent decree. And they weren't parties here. There's nothing they can do about what the underlying parties agreed in the first lawsuit. And the court's worried about that. It seems a little unfair to the Bakers. Now, if that were the only thing, this case could be a really easy case to decide. Because it shouldn't matter whether it's the Missouri court or the Michigan court. If your only concern here is the fact that the Bakers weren't parties, then that's the answer. And even a Michigan court can't enforce this consent decree. Let me give that some concrete life, right? So let's say, instead of suing GM in Missouri, the Bakers sue GM in Michigan. It's the same scenario, right? Because you've got Michigan judgment number one, which is the consent decree saying employee won't testify, and then you've got Michigan court number two. What effect does Michigan court number two have to give the judgment of Michigan court number one? If you're really worried about the third party effects, the answer ought to be the same. Michigan court number two, not only does it not have to, but it cannot enforce the consent decree because the Bakers were not a party. But the court doesn't go that far. So I think the third party effects are part of what's bothering the court, but the court also seems troubled by the fact that this is really crossing state lines. And crossing not just state lines, but so back to my question, why is it that this is about evidence that is particularly problematic for the majority?
Isn't that it interferes with another state's procedure?
Judicial procedure. It's fine and good to tell Missouri that you have to seize assets of GM and sell them because of what Michigan did. It seems to be another thing to majority court to tell Missouri that you have to actually do something different in your courtroom because of what Michigan decided. And in fact, that's what Ginsburg talks about, right? She talks about the difficulty with anti-suit injunctions. A case where the Michigan court enjoins parties from proceeding in another court as being potentially problematic. Some combination of those two things, the fact that this decree, enforcing this decree, will affect third parties who were not part of the prior lawsuit, and the fact that it will affect those third parties and the other state's court in litigation seems to add up to making this just too far, more than full faith and credit requires. Add to that what we just said about, so how would the Missouri court, maybe this is just because it's a prohibition, it's too easy, but how would the Missouri court actually, let's say that this guy actually had good information from GM. And so he had agreed not to testify, he had agreed not to testify, but GM, well, how can I make this not a prohibition? Let's say he had actually agreed as part of the settlement agreement to testify on GM's behalf in subsequent suits. And now he doesn't want to. How would the Missouri court enforce it? Let's say that the full faith and credit clause requires Missouri to honor and enforce in some way that consent decree that he entered into to Michigan in Michigan that says he actually will affirmatively testify on behalf of GM, and now he doesn't want to. What would the Missouri court do? Well, all those things we just talked about, right? Some form of those remedies. It's got to do something to make him actually show up and testify, whether that be putting him in jail until he agrees to testify, fining him until he agrees to testify. Somehow, some way, that seems a little bit more invasive than the court's willing to say full faith and credit requires. And I think that's one of the things that makes trying to figure out, it's fine and good to say this applies in equity, to say that a court has to recognize an equitable decree, but it's pretty tricky to figure out what that really looks like on the ground as a practical matter. What is truly the manner and mechanism for enforcement versus what is actually honoring the decree? And to what extent does Missouri have an obligation to really make whatever remedy it provides in contempt actually be effective and make this happen? I think that's ultimately what makes this a difficult case and why all the justices here ultimately want to say, no, this goes too far. Although, I don't think anybody has a really good comprehensive reason or a reason that holds together nicely for why this is the case. And so I said Scalia, always the nice, simple answer, says, well, the problem here is just that you didn't switch the papers. Although you got to wonder, had they actually switched the papers, what result? Because you could easily have ended up in the same place. GM could have gone into Missouri and filed an action to enforce the settlement decree against the employee. I bet under the Missouri Rules of Civil Procedure, just like under the federal rules and under most states, GM could then consolidate its declaratory judgment or its injunctive action in the Baker's lawsuit. So that GM would be right there in the Baker's lawsuit with its separate piece of paper or asking for its separate piece of paper. That takes care of all of Scalia's issue, and you're still not any further, right? It still begs the question of what is it that Missouri has to do to actually enforce the Michigan judgment. And we still have the ultimate problem about respect for Missouri's sovereignty, in particular with respect to its judicial proceedings. A little less about the third parties, because the Bakers are there arguing, but still the real problem is, because the real issue is to what extent the Missouri court can look behind what the Michigan court did. And so even if the Bakers are present in Missouri, that's only effective if Missouri can look behind what Michigan did. I'm not so sure. Kennedy points out that maybe this is the wrong case to talk about this. Because it turns out that Michigan would not. You know, I said, what happens if these are both in Michigan? Michigan, the second Michigan court, would not enforce the consent decree. You know, the other thing about equity, which I think makes it a different and a difficult case for the court, or maybe makes it an easy case for the court. So you get your $100,000 money judgment, assuming no appeal, the court enters final judgment on the verdict. That's it. End of story. There's no more question about what GM's obligation is. It owes the plaintiff $100,000, period. Equity doesn't work that way. In equity, even after the court issues a final judgment, the trial court has continuing jurisdiction to supervise and modify the injunction as need be. At a certain point, this guy just doesn't, his proprietary information just isn't useful anymore. And he can go in and say, okay, let me be now, let me work for whoever I want to. Or at a certain point, his circumstances have changed just that it's an undue hardship to continue to prohibit this guy from working for another car manufacturer. He can go in and ask the court to modify the injunction. It turns out under Michigan law, that's what Michigan would do. If these lawsuits had both been filed in Michigan, the second Michigan court said, go back to the first Michigan court and ask that court to modify the injunction. So maybe that actually is one thing that makes it easier for the court to want to put limits on the extent to which the enforcing court has to actually enforce, honor the rendering court's judgment, the fact that the winning party still has a remedy there in the winning court. I don't know. But either way, it seems like a sensible result becomes a difficult reason or difficult to articulate the reason why or how you get to that sensible result, other than to say that when you're talking about cases that are going to, enforcement of the decree is going to affect third parties and judicial proceedings, you can be sure the one thing you know from Baker is that the court somehow, some way says you don't have to enforce the decree. Questions? All right, let's end there, and I'll see you guys after spring break. I'll post a syllabus, if not by the end of today, then by the morning. I've got it done. I just want to proofread it one last time.